Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
Look out. There's a signpost up ahead. What it says is caution. Detectives at work. We're going to find out who these detectives are and what they're up to. And all of this is going to happen in 3, 2, 1. And you are listening to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I am in the studio with Mr. Russ Avison in Fillmore, California. Hey, 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 Russ.
Hey, Jimmy, how are you tonight?
Man, I tell you, if I was any better, I'd be under the truck.
I'm not even quite sure I know what that means.
I don't either, but you know what? It sounded good.
I've been told that many times.
Oh, yeah, me too. It's 7 years, Russ, we've been on this air. We've been on the air together. Years almost.
And I still like you.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
I know.
Well, every time I mention Uncle Russ, of course, Bella goes insane.
Hey, I'm going to be coming out to see you again in September.
Perfect. We'll make sure we're here.
Yeah.
We have a really great show lined up tonight. It's a double. Richard and Bobby Jean are going to be chomping at the bit. They will be coming on at 7 o'clock Pacific. 8 o'clock in our time here in Mountain, and then all the way across the country at an hour. They'll be talking exclusively to Tom Lang. But right now, we have two guests in our studio with us, and they are—I'm really, really, really excited to talk to these guys individually. They've been on before by themselves. Tonight, we've got them both together. Welcome to the Writer's Book. Hey, guys, how are you?
Good, Jim. Good talking to you.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Great to hear you. Great to hear you, Jim.
Bob, you live so far away. It's like, you know, it's like we never see you.
Don't make me feel guilty.
I could do that. But anyway, I wanted to bring both of you on because there's a couple reasons. Number one, your book that you co-wrote, which is Malice in Wonderland, about the Wonderland murders in the early 80s. We'd like to kind of cover that a little bit. And then I'd like to talk to you a little bit about a lot about your series that's right now running currently on Hulu, which is A City of Angels, City of Death. And I'm going to let one of you guys, you go ahead, pick up the mantle and explain what that series particular is about, if you would, please.
Go ahead, Tom. You got a handle on it.
City of Angels, City of Death. Actually, Bob and I, of course, worked together going way back to the late 70s at LAPD Robbery Homicide Division and had a lot of good-sized cases, high-publicized cases, and several of which were serial cases back in the mid to late 70s through the 80s and right into the early 90s. Greater LA area experienced something like 30 different serial killers. Some of them were paired up. Some of them the Bonin case that Bob was on had like 5 different killers. And this went on for a little over 20 years, and there were literally hundreds of victims. And Bob and I were right in the middle of this thing, and ironically started with the Laurel Canyon murders. But the unit we were in, the Homicide Special Unit, handled those types of murders citywide. While the city had 18 geographical units, homicide units, ours was a specialized unit because we supposedly had the time and the resources to handle all of these high-profile cases. But we didn't expect to have as many as we did at the same time.
Right.
So as we moved into the 70s, the late 70s and 80s, we had like a half a dozen serial killing cases coming in and out of our jurisdiction. So Bob and I, after we retired, we got to talking about these things, and we've always both been interested in writing, and we took a lot of notes, and we put a lot of things together over the years, and we actually started working on this serial business back, probably 20, 25 years ago at least. And we were writing a book about it and still are. And we came up, ABC liked the story about all of these killers, and so we put this thing together over about 6 or 8 months called City of Angels, City of Death, and it highlights a half a dozen murders that our unit was involved in back in the 70s and the 80s. And that's streaming now on Hulu, like you were saying.
Right. Now, you guys, one of the murders that, in fact, you and I have talked about before, Tom, was Rodney Acala.
The dating game murderer.
Yeah. Can you kind of give us a little background on him? Because he's a fascinating guy.
Yeah, he is. He's not fascinating any longer.
No.
he's dead now. But
it's a terrible thing, I guess, for some people, but not really. Rodney was kind of a nasty SOB. We had him in LAPD. We handled him the first back in 1988, our hollow girl, off the streets of Hollywood in the middle of the daytime. And thank God that someone saw this happen and followed Alcala and this little girl to a rooming house in Hollywood. And he forced her inside. And this pedestrian that was walking by actually called the police. And an officer working by himself showed up to this apartment as Alcala was brutalizing this little 8-year-old girl. He'd sexually molested her and had her down on the ground and had a crowbar over her neck and was killing her.
Uh-huh.
And officer came to the door just on the suspicion from this pedestrian and banged on the door. And Alcala came to the front and looked out the window with his eyes bugging out. And it was apparent to the officer he had no clothes on. And the officer said, "This just doesn't look right. Something is really going wrong here." And just felt that he had to do something and do it now. So he kicked the door in. He physically kicked the door in and went inside. And there was this little girl lying there with this crowbar across her neck. And Alcala jumped up and ran out the back. Well, this led to him being wanted for a period of like 7 or 8 years, I guess. And Alcala took off, went back to New York, and was back there for several years, and actually was responsible for 2 or 3 murders in the New York area, and then returned to California and picked up where he left off in New York and killed a couple of more here. We had one of the murders, the Jill Barkham case, girl was found in the Hollywood Hills. And at the same time, we had the Hillside Strangler going.
Right.
So we didn't know if Jill Barkham victim was one of the Hillside Stranglers victims or not, because we were getting so many at the same time. And then, of course, just prior to that, we had the toolbox because we were kidnapping me. So we had all these things going on at the same time and didn't realize that we're more than one serial killer. And then during this time, of course, this guy Alcala appears on the dating game.
Right.
And right after he killed a half dozen young women, probably, and once he won, and I guess the girl that he dated after that got freaked out with him, and he went out and he killed a couple more, and that's basically the story of Alcala. Of course, I believe he got the death penalty, and he was in prison, and like I said, he just passed away here last July. I think he was 77 years old. But this guy would go out and pose as a photographer to some malls, which wasn't a common MO, but it was an MO that was used by 2 or 3 other serial killers of the time. And he'd go out to these young girls and tell them, you know, that they looked like they could be models, and they were all set to go in and start their careers as models and this other thing. And a couple of them he ended up taking out to the desert and killing. When he was arrested, they checked out where he was staying, and he had literally hundreds and hundreds of photographs of young women, principally, but also some young men, and that the detectives at the time tried to run down to see if there were more victims, which they to this day believe that there were, because he took these photographs and kept them of these victims.
Right.
So
right.
He was one of the more vicious, nastier
right.
of the bunch. And there were a whole bunch of them back then that were just as nasty.
Yeah, didn't he have a whole bunch of stuff stashed in a storage locker?
Yeah, he used
one of those photos. I believe they
and stuff like that.
Yeah, which is a common thing for a lot of serial killers to take a little momentum from their victims and keep it. We solved a couple of those serial killing cases with that type of evidence.
Yeah.
So that's one thing you'd certainly look for in a serial killing case.
Yeah. You know, I was really struck by one of these victims, the young lady he took from the beach. I was struck at how closely she resembled Kimberly Ann Leach, Ted Bundy's victim in Florida. Yeah. She looked a lot like her, and I was wondering if possibly, you know, Rodney was trying to imitate Bundy in some of the stuff he was doing.
Well, I guess that's possible, but these guys are so into themselves. They're sociopathic, obviously, but they're way on that.
That was one of the things that I wanted to ask you. I just finished watching the entire series on Hulu yesterday, and then I rewatched a couple of the episodes today. And a couple things. One is, I guess the big question is, because you've had a chance to interview a lot of these guys, what do you find that's in common with them, besides the fact that they're sociopaths? But what makes them different or unique but common?
Good question, Bob. I'll throw that to Bob because he's got a good example he can give you about talking to serial killers.
Yeah, well, I had an opportunity to have a chat with one of the toolbox killers, Ray Norris, who gave us a lot of insight. We were looking to get in the mind of a serial killer, and so we went to talk to Roy Norris, who was linked up with Lawrence Biddick, and everything to him. And I think this is common among all of them. The serial killers that I know of, they all have a common trait of they're socially inept for one thing. They're almost a dual personality because they have a way to be charming and yet just to lure their victims. But I think the fact that they have no, absolutely zero feelings about anything but themselves, and it's most of it's sexual gratification. And I think a sociopath, not all sociopaths are murderers, but in this case, all the ones we dealt with are pretty much sociopaths. I think the interesting thing about Akala, one thing I thought about was that the girl that was on the show who chose him, she looked right through him. She told the casting people with that show, I don't want to deal with him.
Right.
And we deal with quite a bit of that in our show, in our docuseries. And of course, Akala is just one of six or seven that we dealt with and in the series. But when I talked to Roy Norris, he told me things like, first of all, he said, listen, I'll talk to you, but I can't talk to you about the cases that Larry and I did. I said, that's fine. I don't give a shit about those. Let's talk about Bond. He said, yeah, I know about Bond. I've been reading about it in the paper. He says, you're looking for probably two guys. It makes it easier to move bodies around, for one thing. He says they probably have a place to dump the bodies before they even snatch somebody. And he even told me that he and Biddicker went up in Angeles Crest highways with bolt cutters. They cut off the locks to the fence, put their own locks on there so they'd come in and out where they dump their bodies.
Jeez.
These guys were so, you know, they're not stupid. I mean, they're very street smart. He told us that we're probably looking for a van with a sliding door. That way, when they opened the door, you couldn't see it from the front or the rear.
Right, right.
Pull a victim in right off the street. So he was giving me this kind of insight and talking to me like you and I would discuss we're going to have lunch tomorrow. And he actually went off, started talking about the cases that he and Biddicker had done in a bragging sense. When my partner and I walked out after talking to him for about 2 hours, we walked out to the car and my partner looked at me and said, you ever felt more like having a drink in your life? And I said, I want to go back in and shoot yourself.
hey guys, we're going to have to take a real quick break. Bob, hold that thought, if you wouldn't mind, and don't go away. Please don't hang up. And you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is Writer's Block. And we'll be right back with you at a word from Tony Abel.
The end on a book that makes Rowling's look like Jack and Jill went up the hill, that makes Tolkien's look like a trip to the store, and finishes a series better than George R.R. Martin? But you don't know how to get your book into the hands of readers?
No!
Well, look, before you throw that manuscript in the trash and set Warp 10, for Get Me the Hell Out of Here, go to TuscanyBayBooks.com, click on the submissions tab, tell us all about your book, and we'll get back in touch with you and we'll help you get that thing formatted, edited, get a great book cover for it, get it out there so that people can read it, and let you know how to market it too, so that you can do the most important thing, write your next book. That's TuscanyBayBooks.com. Go there today.
Hello.
There we go. I had my microphone turned off. And once again, we're back with you. And we've got on the air with Mr. Bob Souza and Tom Lang. And they've finished a series on Hulu called City of Angels, City of Death. And Mr. Avison, you have your finger up.
I do.
Okay.
So I had a question about the Sunset Strip killers, because we're talking about sociopaths. And Doug Clark and Carol Bundy. But Carol Bundy was the one who called in the tip to say, hey, you know what? I've been killing some people with this guy, but he wants to keep doing it over and over and over again, and I can't live with myself anymore. So was Carol Bundy a sociopath? And she made a comment. She said killing people was fun. And it just blew me away. And I'm wondering, like, I just cannot fathom what goes through the mind of a serial killer when I heard that interview or when she called into the police. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
You know, I was going to ask a question,
I think, Russ, with her comments about being a sociopath, that she enjoyed the killing. There's different levels of sociopaths. You know, there's a lot of politicians that you could call sociopathic, but they're not going to go out.
But they still are. But
yeah. I think most of Washington, but yeah.
Yeah. We could go a little deeper with that, I think. But anyway, there's one thing that we did learn that I thought was important that Bob and I talk about. Dealt these people, them and good cop, bad cop, and that's BS, basically. People that we have interviewed, if you treat them with a certain modicum of respect, and they develop a little bit of that from you, and you can talk to them just like we're talking now, you're going to get a whole lot more out of them. Because a lot of these guys and gals like to talk about themselves and their own accomplishments. And, you know, that's what Bob did with Norris. And he put himself down at Norris's level and says, I'm not interested in anything you guys did. I got another problem here. I thought you could tell me about it. So you show some respect for them. They show some respect for you. And you'd be surprised what you can get out of a lot of these people. And that worked out for us very well in many of these cases.
Are you ever wrong? I think cops are probably the most intuitive people when it comes to, but sometimes I would assume you make mistakes. Have there been any big mistakes?
I can tell you one on a Hollywood case I handled. I had an elderly woman. It was during the West Side Rapist case. We didn't really touch on that in the docuseries. Mm-hmm. We were hoping to get sequel because we discussed more about, because this involved about 45 or 50 elderly women. Some were raped, some were murdered. But one of the cases I handled, we had it was a kind of a burglary situation. We had a good set of prints at the point of entry in a window. And the number one suspect, we had the victim would go to I. Magnum's on Wilshire Boulevard every day for lunch. And she would call a cab. The cab would take her. She'd also get a ride coming back home. She did this every day during the week. Well, we thought we should check on this because of cab drivers. A lot of cab drivers at that time, at least, were ex-cons, and we had a possible suspect. So this one cab driver that took her home the day that she was murdered, in the entry, you know, they have to tell when they pick up their passenger and when they drop them off. Well, where he dropped her off, it was blank on his card that he turned in. Now, I went to the Yellow Cab Company. I said, I want to look at all your records. And they were very accommodating. I mean, we didn't need search warrants in those days. But I started going through these records, and I said, you know, I'm not seeing any blank entries on these, especially on drop-offs. They said, oh, that's very rare. That doesn't just doesn't happen. And I went through hundreds of these things. I could not find one where the drop-off time, except on this. Maybe this guy did that, and he was so worked up after he murdered this woman that he just overlooked it in his haste. Well, I grilled this guy. I raked him over the coals, pretty much accused him of everything. I didn't book him, but I kept coming back for like 5 days, just really leaning on him because I felt very strongly about it. I got, finally, I got him printed. He didn't have a record. I got him printed, and the prints did not match. And I thought, oh, boy. So about the same time, we found out I had two Metro officers who we used to get on loan to help us. And I said, hey, guys, this was a luxury. Like Tom was saying, we have time to do things. I had the luxury of having these two detectives. I said, I want everybody printed in that building. If they don't have a record, then bring your own print kit. I want everybody printed to compare those prints in the entry. I said, I know we're going to get this guy. Well, about 2 weeks. Now, this was before I actually had prints on him. So anyway, they came back with prints on a boyfriend of one of the girls living in the building. Solid make on this guy. And then found out he'd also pawned some of her jewelry. So now we had a real suspect. And I actually had to go back. I had to apologize to this guy. I apologized to his boss. I said, listen, I explained to him why he looked like such a good suspect. And I asked him, why the hell did you not put in the time that you dropped her off? He couldn't explain it. He said he had no idea. But that's one of those red herrings, one of those weird things in the case. But yeah, I was wrong. And I had to rectify that by, I apologized to his family, to his boss, and explained to them why we were leaning on him.
Do you ever worry about one of those guys coming back after you because they just hold the grudge?
No, I think he was happy that he wasn't.
I'm sure
he wasn't going to screw with you after 5 days of being tortured.
He was pretty happy to get me off his back, I'm sure.
Yeah,
that's a good point that Bob was saying, and that shows you why Bob was such a good homicide cop, because he just told you that he was wrong. You got to be able to say that to yourself, because we make mistakes like everyone else, but you've got to understand when you do, you got to swallow it and you got to keep moving on. And that's why all of these cases, believe it or not, every one of them was solved because of that. So we're not always going to be right. You just keep going. And that old homicide cliche comes into play. When all else fails, go with the evidence. And if you keep on it long enough, you're going to find that evidence.
Yeah. By the way, I just out of curiosity, did you either of you work with the Richard Ramirez case? Because when you were just talking about the lady that got killed and there were some break-ins and they were older ladies, it reminded me, I think Ramirez was going into open window.
Yeah, this all was different. Before. Ramirez was at the end of the serial killer era. He was like the last one caught. But the West Side Rapes I was working on was back in the 70s, and Ramirez was picked up in the 80s. But if you can believe this, I had at least five different suspects who were raping and murdering elderly women.
Jeez.
Five different.
One of them graduated onto other things back into the 80s, a guy by the name of Brandon Fulmer, who was one of Bob's suspects on the West Side, who was one of the rapists. He wasn't convicted of any of the murders. Fulmer went on to be called the old lady killer and kill, what, like 32 elderly women, most of them in the Los Feliz area.
Jeez.
Is it because they're good targets?
Well, he discovered that, and certainly they were. He used to follow these elderly women home, and he would check out where they lived, and he would make sure that they were alone. And he not only just attacked, but he would take things and beat them and rape them and all sorts of nasty things. And these were all elderly women, and this went on for some time. But like I said, I believe there were something like 32 of them.
Yeah, and I think he
graduated from just being the rapist to now raping and killing.
So, now we have a sociopath, and with a fetish. You know, you have how many people are really, you know, sexually interested in elderly women. So that becomes a psychological thing. That this was one of the things we talked about a little bit in the docuseries. It wasn't up to us to psychoanalyze these assholes. You know, we just wanted to put them in jail. And
yeah.
Of course, they're out on the coast and they're at Tattoo State Hospital. They're interviewed. We find out that a lot of it is fetish that dates back to when they were children and maybe a single mother, dominating mother. But what, when you look at a guy like Ramirez, everybody was a victim. Yeah, young girls, old people, these shot and killed men in their beds. I mean,
yeah,
this guy was
yeah.
so, he was such a threat in the city. It was the first time I ever slept with a gunner in my pillow.
Yeah.
He was that.
Yeah.
He affected even the cops. This guy was just nothing more scarier than what we called a hot prowl rapist. And he was a hot prowl rapist murderer, which made him really.
But the last place he tried to get in, then the neighborhood beat the crap out of him.
Yeah,
people. Yeah.
What was so fascinating, and I'm going to for a few minutes, the Wonderland murders. What was so fascinating about that? Was it because it was a retaliation type thing, or because John Holmes was involved, or all of the above?
All of the above and more. That investigation actually, Jim, went on for over 20 years.
Yeah, I know. I remember you telling us that at dinner one night. Yeah.
Yeah, and it had just everything you could imagine. You know, the pornography angle with John Holmes, organized crime, corruption at the police level, corruption at the judiciary, corruption in the DA's office, corruption in the jury. They bought off a juror. They bought off witnesses. They tried to buy us off. There were people that threatened. They were threatened. There were two or three other murders that people forgot about that were directly involved with the Laurel Canyon murders because they were around too long and probably knew too much. There was a judge involved that had a problem with cocaine, and he ended up initially sentencing the organized crime figure here, Ed Nash, to 8 years.
Right.
But he was also dependent on Nash and his people for his cocaine habit. So he ended up reducing that sentence by about 6 years.
Yeah. I often wonder because, you know, I've been up in Laurel Canyon and up on Wonderland Drive, and I can't see how any murders took place up there without half the neighborhood hearing about it. I mean, it's so closely compact up there. It's like houses are on top of houses.
A wild neighborhood, and that house was busy with people coming by 24 hours a day. You know, I'll tell you, of all the cases that Tom handled over the years, collectively and individually, how many times do you see a superior court judge and a federal agent being bought off? I mean, that's movie shit. You know, you can't make that up.
That's true.
It was the first time either one of us had ever been told to back off somebody. We had total autonomy for years working homicide, and all of a sudden, you know, we don't want you to arrest Nash. And that went all the way up to Tom Bradley, the mayor. I mean, it was... There was so much under the covers that we were just amazed. And then we start hearing about all these people that were bought off.
Yeah.
Nash tried to buy Tom and I.
Yeah. Nash owned a club downtown, right?
That was in the courthouse.
He had a nightclub down. Was it Van Nuys or something? Yeah.
Seven nightclubs in the Hollywood area.
Yeah.
Yeah, for some of the people who don't know about that particular murder, can you just kind of thumbnail a little?
I love to hear Tom's version of it. I like it.
Careful, guys. I have the book.
Yeah, a drug gang working out of Wonderland. They were ripping off dope dealers, and one of their customers and somebody they ran with was John Holmes, who was probably the best known porn actor of that particular time period back in July of 1981.
Right.
So Holmes was getting his drugs from the Wonderland gang. He was also getting his drugs from Ed Nash, who at the time was probably the biggest dealer in L.A. County, maybe Southern California. So he was getting drugs from both sides and running his movies at the same time, these porn movies. And he decided once that it might be a good idea because Ed Nash has a lot of dope hanging around, a lot of money, a lot of good things. So he went to the Wonderland gang there and told them that this Ed Nash is dealing all his dope up at his house in Studio City, and I can get you in there. We can really have a big score. And, of course, these Wonderland folks were all hopped up all the time anyway, and so they set this plan into motion where John Holmes would go to Nash's house one day and leave a rear sliding glass door unlocked. And that early one morning, which would be June, probably of 30th, but June, probably 29th of 1981. He left the slider open and he went back to Wonderland, which is as a crow flies, there's 2 miles from Ed Nash's house down Laurel Canyon. So these guys came in there. There were 4 of them. One of them was the driver who kept the stolen car running out in the street while the other 3 went in the slider and got inside and roused up Nash and his bodyguard, Greg Dials, and roughed him up. And there was a little tussle at one time, and one of the robbers shot Dials, just grazed him. They cuffed him up and humiliated him, took their money, took their guns, took all their dope, and they all took all the stuff and ran outside in the middle of the daytime into this car driven by this moron by the name of Tracy McCourt, who forgot to gas the car up. Getaway. So they're pushing down the street, going down the hill. We kind of roll down the hill on to get back to their place a couple of miles away in Laurel Canyon. So to give you back to the thumbnail thing, it's kind of hard to do, but yes. What happened within a day or so, Nash found out that the lynching here was they beat the crap out of them, and they said, you were going to tell us who's involved in this, or your family's going to pay the price along with you. And so, of course, idiot ass there rolled over. And the next 2 days later, Holmes was told to go back to Wonderland. I'm going to send some folks over there about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I want you to open the door because that'd be probably a good time because everybody's going to be bombed out. So he did, and there were 3 or 4 at least suspects that went over there. We do believe we had them ID'd. Of course, that's another story, but they knocked on the door, and John Holmes let them in, knowing full well what their intentions were. And these folks went through the house with lead pipes and just beat the piss out of everybody in there, killing 4 of the 5. The one girl, Susie Launius, lived. Of course, she was damaged beyond being able to recognize or remember anything. And right. These 4 were all, you know, badasses anyway. They committed armed robberies. One of them we had tied to a couple of other murders that had happened in Hollywood prior to that. It was Launius, Ron Launius. So they were badasses to begin with. And this is what Bob and I ended up with, just a house full of corpses beaten. It's bloody, bloody scene, the bloodiest that I've ever seen.
Wow.
And we were there for like 30 hours with the criminalists trying to put this together. And wow. It went from there for 20 years until there was someone finally convicted, and that was Nash when the feds got involved years later on a RICO statute. And that's why we wrote the book after all these years, because during the middle of this, of course, there was a dirty fiddle that Nash, Bill Gates, our chief, and says Lang and Sousa are dirty. They've been in bed with organized crime, and you ought to look at them because they're covering for Ed Nash. So unbeknownst to Bob and I, we're getting followed around wherever we go. Our own people are investigating us. Well, this was part of Nash's idea because he couldn't buy us off. So this was the next level that he went to, and yes. We didn't know what was going on. Now, the thing is with this investigation, they knew nothing would come of it because Bob and I were not dirty. We didn't do any of that crap. We didn't know what was going on, but the irony of all of this was that investigation that says Lang and Sousa and Bob's brother was also drawn into this could have been dirty would be become discoverable in a trial, in a murder trial with Nash.
Right.
All they needed was that one juror to throw this thing out. So anything that we obviously weren't dirty, but they still could have used that per discovery to say, oh, LA cops are dirty, and this is what they did, that and the other. And of course, when the trials came around later, they did in fact buy off a juror. Money wasn't paid out properly to the right people, and the juror's brother was murdered because of it. So, I mean, this goes on and on and on throughout these 20 years, and that's why.
Wow.
You know,
Okay, hang on just a second, Bob. We're going to let you talk, but right now we got another take a real quick break. You are listening to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block, and we'll be back right with you after a brief word from LA Talk Radio.
If you have never listened to LA Talk Radio, then you need to treat yourself to one of the best online live radio stations around. If you have listened to talk radio, and let's be honest, found yourself saying, do that, we have 50-minute slots available all day, Saturdays and Sundays included. And we're looking to fill those slots with high-quality broadcasts from talk hosts that are in the know. If you think you have what it takes, go to www.latalkradio.com and click the link that says Become a Host. Then just follow the simple instructions. Before you know it, you'll be joining the legion of radio folks that got their start right here at LA Talk Radio. That's www.latalkradio.com. You have something to say. Now let's hear it. LA Talk Radio.
And we are back. It is now 6:38, and we are on the line with Mr. Bob Souza and Mr. Tom Lang. Okay, Bob, your turn.
Well, I was going to say that to give you an idea of how deep this went, Ted Nash wouldn't pull off the fact that he had a federal agent working for him who was also head of a federal task force that actually investigated the arson cases he was on. So somewhere in that mix, he was able to buy off this Fed. And he also bought off a couple other LAPD cops that we're pretty sure of. But as the puppet master, he was so smart. He knew that if a complaint came in about Tom and I being involved in organized crime or being on the take, he knew that one source wouldn't be enough really to take it really serious. Because Tom and I had, we had pretty sterling records beyond all that crap. But he was smart enough, it came from three different sources. And he arranged that. One was a prisoner in federal custody. There was a bail bondsman and also this relationship from all sourcing into it. Would have been nice if somebody dropped a dime on us to let us know, but that didn't happen. So we were pretty much cleared, but it just shows you how conniving this guy was.
Yeah.
He's not either. We don't miss him much, but as a puppet master, this guy was, he was pretty shrewd all the way up to the time of his trial when they bought off a juror, like Tom said, $50,000 bought off a juror enough to affect the case and
later
on the feds. I don't think the feds really like to have their dirty laundry out in public. So I think he kind of retired in lieu of disciplinary action. That's what it looks like to me. And then he went to work, of course. His business address was Ed Nash's restaurant or nightclub on Hollywood Boulevard.
Is there a prevalence of dirty cops in LAPD, or was there?
You know, I got to be honest with you. I never saw it. I mean, you always heard about New York and Boston and New Orleans, but I never really saw it with LAPD. I mean, there were always jokes about it. You know, I remember a New York cop was sitting there while I was doing an affidavit for a search warrant, and he said, "What do you got going on here?" I said, "I'm getting a search warrant, doing an affidavit." He said, "So what's in the pad?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. That's why we're getting a warrant." He says, "Oh, you mean you didn't toss the pad first?" So,
in the affidavit, right?
Yeah. So we had never seen things like that, you know. And this, there were always dirty cops. I mean, let's face it. They were as years went on. They found one with the sheriff's department and LAPD.
Right.
A big operator called Big Time Spender. These guys were taking dope money back. But as a general rule, from the time I started on the job until Tom and I ran it, I never really saw any serious graft or corruption, even with partners. Just never saw it. This was the first time that I had ever been told just to not put somebody in jail or to have somebody involved in my investigation.
The LAPD, the sheriffs, any major city police department is forced to recruit from the human race.
Okay? Sure.
One thing I always remember, the first thing I was ever taught when I was 18 years old in the Marine Corps was there's always a 10%. I don't care where you go in life.
That's right.
Just look around, and there they are. And the police is no different.
That's right.
So much less of that today, however, than there ever was. It's overdone. You see these TV shows, and that's another reason why we wrote this book. That's the reason why we do some documentaries. That's the reason why we did this series, to try to say, hey, wait a minute. That's the crap that you're seeing is just that. It's crap. Not all cops are dirty. Some cops actually respect what they do for a living, and they care what they do for a living, and that's where they're good at what they do for the living, for a living, and they don't get involved in this nonsense. That's a good reason to write a book, and that's a good reason to do a series.
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I was going to say, this case, it seems like it's like the case that just keeps on going. You know, even after all was said and done, and we had written the book and everything else, Michael Connelly, the famous author,
right,
he decided to podcast about Wonderland and kind of focusing on Liberace's boyfriend. Telling it from a whole different point of view. And Tom and I were involved with the podcast, of course, and we saw things that we did. Michael dug up things that we did. We had no idea. These interviews that he did with Thorson are just amazing to us, because it kind of filled in a lot of blanks that we had over the years.
Right.
We had the cop standpoint in our investigation, but we didn't know that much about Homer at that time. Podcast was very interesting for us to work on, because it filled a lot of gaps. In fact, we kind of wanted to go back and maybe in our second book revisit the Wonderland case a little bit, because of all the information that Connelly dug up, you know. That kind of, well, to me, it kind of what rounded out the whole case. When you hear Thorson's actual report, whatever.
Right. Well, you know, I wanted to touch on that subject next, and I'm glad you brought that up. It's a great segment. You guys have a long podcast with Michael Connelly, and it was touching on the Wonderland case and others. Either one of you want to delve into what you guys discussed on that particular podcast?
The one we did with him?
Right.
Yeah, well, he came from a different angle, and basically that's what this case would have needed, a different angle, because Wonderland has been hit from all sides. There were three major motion pictures. None of them were reality at all.
Right.
They were all BS. A lot of documentaries which were nonsense. Now, Bob and I were given a script to that one Wonderland movie, and they wanted us to TA it, and we said, no, this is all crap. We don't want anything to do with it.
Right.
Others, they highlight someone like John Holmes. Well, Michael went with Scott Carson, liberating angle, but frankly, didn't have a whole lot to do with our murder investigation. He was a player on the periphery of the case, did not cooperate with us at all. Initially, because number one, he was involved with Liberace, and they had broken up, and there was a civil case involved, and he didn't want to get killed. I mean, basically, that's so we tapped him initially, and then he disappeared for 8 years.
Right.
And he got his tit in the ringer 8 years later, and he calls me from the jail, and now he wants to talk. This is 8 years later. But Connelly, is being as sharp as Michael is, he came up with this angle. And it came off really, really well. But it's got a lot less to do with the actual murder investigation and more to do with the Hollywood story. And he
Scott Thorson was on drugs, didn't he?
Yeah, and he was there the night that they beat up Holmes, supposedly. That Dials beat on Holmes, and had some information that he could have given us, but he took off. And so, like I said, for 8 years,
right,
we did that until he got caught up in some problems of his own.
Right, right. Gotcha, gotcha.
Well, it's a story. It's Hollywood, and it's a very interesting story.
Well, yeah.
Michael gets in the underbelly of Hollywood, and that's pretty popular stuff, you know?
Oh, well, yeah, but you know, Bob, you've worked with Hollywood for quite a few years now. You've been a technical advisor on at least two shows that I know of.
I also worked on two movies, two feature films that
right.
Kind of Dark Blue with Kurt Russell was not friendly to LAPD, and I kind of wanted to bring a sense guy in because it looked so bad for our unit SIS.
That was a great movie, though, I have to say.
I think I thought Kurt did a beautiful job in that movie.
He really did.
Yeah, and I kind of explained to the surveillance cop, I said, you know, this is a story. I mean, it's but SIS guys are pretty proud of what they do, and they are terrific cops. This was about a bad one, you know, and I tried to keep it as far. You know, original script was written by James Ellroy, and it was 145 pages of people you can't stand. And Ron Shelton, there's not a character in this goddamn thing I even like. And so then they gave it to David Ayer, who wrote Training Day and a few other really good movies. And David Ayer cleaned it up. And then Ron, they gave it to Ron. We're going to rewrite it again. I said, oh, well, all right. So we went through page by page, and I tried to keep it's hard when you're dealing with a bad cop to keep it. But we had to make Kurt a likable character. And he, in fact, one day I talked to Kurt Russell, and he said, "By what? So where are we with this character?" I said, you know what, Kurt? This is somewhere between Captain Ron and Snake Plissken. And if you know Kurt's movies, yep. He looked at me and said, oh,
yeah.
It was a real dark, it was a very dark movie.
It was a very dark movie.
My wife
We got to take one more break, guys. No, don't go away. We'll be right back with you. And right now, we're going to have a real brief word from Creative Edge Publicity.
I was sitting in my private office looking out my private window, dropping private eye drops in my private eye, when a tall blonde walked by, and now you ask me how I know she was tall. My office is on the second floor. And then there was a knock on the door, so I jumped out of my chair, I tripped over the couch, I unlatched the latch, and there stand a beautiful blonde holding a manuscript, and I said, hi. She said, hi. What can I do for you? I said, well, she said, I have a manuscript and I want my book published. And I said, well, you've come to the right place. This is Tuscany Bay Books, and that's exactly what we do. Why don't you come in and we'll have a drink on it, but all I have is a bottle of ink. So we drank that and stood around feeling mighty blue, but you don't have to feel mighty blue, because at Tuscany Bay, we'll not only format your book, we'll proofread it, we'll edit it, we'll get it printed, and we'll bitch you a cover that will make your head spin and make you so proud of the work that you've done. Tuscany Bay Books, you can't go wrong, and you can find us on the web at www.tuscanybaybooks.com. And if you see a blonde walk by holding a manuscript and a bottle of blue ink, just say hi.
And we are back, and actually that wasn't Creative Edge, that was another Tuscany Bay ad, but guys, I don't even remember, next book coming up, Tuscany Bay Books, put the mantra, Tuscany Bay Books, Tuscany Bay Books. okay, we are, what were we talking about? I forgot.
Well, we were talking about Dark Blue, actually.
Oh, Dark Blue, yeah, great movie. But you also were technical advisor on Cold Case.
Yeah, for seven seasons. That was a
I love that show. And Tom, I know you've done a lot of documentaries. You've done some with people I don't know, and we find with a Tom Lang in it, because Jerry always goes, "Hey, we know him." We make everybody watch our show. Oh, we know Tom. You know, but
you know, Bob, you know, and I do those, but we like to you know, we're not actors, we're not entertainers, and these are mostly done for entertainment, but we rather think that they're done to educate and to tell people this is what really happens.
Oh, absolutely.
And we've done them together now, probably pushing 25 years.
Right.
And that's what we want to do, is to educate what really happens. Because so many documentaries, they're just not factual, and they fill in the blanks themselves. We fill in our blanks with facts, and that's primarily, I think, why we like to do them.
Well, we know that to be true, especially with you. But and I also know that you guys are working on, but you guys are now working on another project with Michael Connelly, who incidentally is one of my very favorite writers. Harry Bosch is like the best.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'll tell you that.
I'm sorry?
Good guy. He's not a Hollywood moron.
Yeah. Yeah, I would one day I'd love to have him on the show. So if you guys want to make the suggestion while you're dealing with him, that would be great. But Michael Connelly is one of our favorites. So
he's kind enough to be on our docuseries with it, and I think he kind of he gave us a really nice thread through the whole thing. Tom and I, consulting producers on that docuseries, Star Price was our third partner in it as the director. The nice thing that Star Price listened. He was a good listener. He listened to us. He said, "Listen, I don't want any phony bullshit." He says, "I want to hear it the way it is." And it came across. Most people I've talked to, it's very heavy. I have a couple of friends that couldn't watch it. They said it's too much for me. I don't want to know all those details. And I said, "Well, you like true crime? There it is." And we didn't hold.
Crime is ugly.
Without the lipstick.
Yeah, crime is ugly, and true crime is uglier. So, you know.
And then if you look at Jim.
Then you look at me, and I'm already ugly, and I have a face made for radio. So, you know, it is what it is. But,
you know,
we've had, you know, there's no reason we can't have Michael Connelly. We've had John Sanford.
Yeah, there you go.
So, there you go.
Good name.
Yeah.
Maybe Tom and I ought to interview you about your writing. I don't know if you've ever discussed it on the show, but I've read three of your books that are terrific. I love Westerns anyway. So.
I love to write, and I'm glad you guys – well, Tom's wrote me a really nice review on Jefferson's Chance, which I thought was phenomenal.
Well, it's fun books. I read every one of your books.
Well, thank you, Tom.
All here. Every one of them.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that you know you're enjoying my storytelling, and as soon as I get and Tom, I know your address, but Bob, as soon as you get moved to LA, you need to make sure that I have your current address, because as soon as I finish this new one, you'll like it. It's about a Texas Ranger, so.
Oh, that's outstanding. You know, Jim, I remember when we first met, we were talking about your books, and after my wife read three of them, and I've read. I think all but one, maybe. And I remember I told you that I like Louis L'Amour, and you said, "This ain't no Louis L'Amour."
You'll never find Louis L'Amour here. And you said, through your beer, you said, "Boy, isn't that the truth?"
Halfway through your first book, I said, "Boy, is that the truth? This ain't no Louis L'Amour."
No. In fact, I think that was The Return. That's a great book. So, but anyway, I'm glad you like it, and I'm glad Tom likes it. And I see two people here that have just joined us. They're going to be taking the second hour. Guys, meet, please, Bobby Jean Bell and Richard Paulinelli.
Hello, hello.
And Tom Lang.
How are you?
We're doing okay, but you may not think the same after we get done with you the next hour.
I got to run out of here.
You know, my name's Bob Souza. You've already introduced me. But I have to tell you one thing about this OJ case. I was not involved in it. I was already retired. But just before Tom gets started, I've got to tell you, I was up fishing in Bishop. I was retired, enjoying the good life. And I was in this little cafe, and we're having breakfast. And I look up at this TV hanging on the wall. It was one of those old-fashioned black-and-white TVs with no sound. and I see the famous white Bronco.
Well, car chase.
I see Tom's image on the screen. And I thought, what the hell? So I called Tom, and I said, Tom, what the hell's going on? He said, you haven't heard? I said, no, I don't have any idea. He says, well, OJ just killed his wife and her boyfriend. I said, you got to be kidding me. Is it a good case? He said, I wish all the cases you and I handle were this good. OJ. And yeah. I'll never forget that as long as I live. And as it turned out, of course, it didn't turn out. It was not the end. I wasn't bullshit. I knew that he wasn't past anything. He was telling me partner to partner, this is the way it is. And there was never any doubt. And I thought, this is going to be quite a case as it goes on. And as we all know, I'm going to leave this one up to Tom.
There you go. Hey, Bob, thanks for joining us. I you know what? We still need to do lunch again, as I said earlier. So, you know, let's set aside some time and let's go eat.
Should we put a plug in for Sully's?
Sure.
Sully's Bar and Grill in downtown.
Sully's Bar and Grill. Great place.
Driving Star, Idaho, yeah.
There you go. Right there at the house, and we can crawl home.
Yeah, there you go. I'm going to kick back and listen to the rest of this.
Okay.
Thanks so much. It was great meeting both of you.
Same here.
My pleasure.
And thanks both of you for joining us. And
let her rip.
Okay.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
The story you're about to see is true.
It was March 24th, and it was cold in Los Angeles, but we weren't there, so we didn't care. Got a call from our captain, the bookie. There was a 5150, a radio show in progress, and she wanted us on the case. That's my partner, Bobby Jean Bell. My name's Polinelli. I carry an iPad. I recorded it, but I'm blaming Jim for this one.
You're killing me. You're killing me, Rich. Yes. And I'm going to leave you guys with Mr. Lang and whatever he wants to tell you. Believe it, it's gospel. Tom, thanks for joining us. We'll get together soon. Take care, guys. Have fun.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
All right. We are off and running on hour two of this special edition of The Writer's Block. And, of course, I'm Richard Polinelli, the person who comes up with these crazy openings that we come up with every once in a while. I am joined by Bobby Jean Bell, who I believe has a certain house in her background.
I do.
Fortunately, Tom can't see it. Otherwise, he'd probably be yelling at us right now. Tom, right off the bat, thank you very much for doing this and for joining us for an extra hour.
My pleasure.
Tom, in case this has not been mentioned in the first hour, and I've had one of those afternoons where I just barely got here in time, so I don't know if it's been brought, but late evidence dismissed, which deals with the OJ case, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. My connection to the case was that, unfortunately, I was working at the Modesto Bee on the copy desk at the time this all went down, and somehow or another, it turned out to be my job to go through all the copy that was coming across the wire and sort out what was going to make the paper and what wasn't. I kind of, just because of that process, got into the case. So I've always wanted to talk to somebody who's been involved with it directly, and so tonight's my chance. If you are listening and you want to talk to Tom and ask us any questions, give us a call at 323-203-0815. And we'll get you on, and we'll see where it goes. So feel free to call in. We look forward to hearing. Kind of backwards here. Let's start off with the trial, because it was such a crazy case from start to finish. I'm wondering, was there a point during the proceedings where it occurred to you that OJ was going to walk out of that courtroom a free man? Because there is a point in the trial that realization hit me, and it's not the glove coming on, the glove's not fitting. I'm wondering, did you ever at any point think, oh my God, this thing, he's gonna walk out of here?
I thought that from Richard, I thought that probably from the first week. And
okay.
There's a number of reasons for that. But let me premise what I'm gonna say first with my feelings on cameras in the room. It doesn't, and that was a circus.
Mm-hmm.
People play to the camera, defense, prosecution, judge, media, of course, whatever. It doesn't do anybody any good. It affects evidence. Testimony is evidence, and it affects evidence. People aren't themselves when testifying in front of 50 million people, and that's what the media was reporting, who was watching this spectacle. And the other thing was, why in hell weren't the attorneys on both sides gagged? There were only two gagged in that whole trial for 9 months, me and my partner. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
As far as what happened, just to answer your question more specifically, I spent a little over 8 days on the stand. And when you testify, every now and again, they go to a sidebar, and you knew then the camera was going off of you and off to the side. There were 25 sides in the evening there, and you could hear a pin drop because the folks, the judge and the attorneys are talking at sidebar. And I'm only maybe 6 feet away from the jury box, and you'd look over there and perhaps nod to the jury, acknowledging them, which shows respect for them and the fact that they're there. Maybe give them a faint smile, and you would look away just to be normal. And every time I did that, when I was on direct from Marcia, they'd be glaring at me. And I don't mean just glaring to glare. I mean, it was with real hate. They don't like me, or they don't like cops, or they don't like something. When I was testifying, they would continue to glare. However, when I was on cross with Johnny Cochran, they'd be writing like crazy with all the BS coming out of his mouth. And so I knew at that point we were in trouble.
Yeah. You know, it brings a point. It's going to bring like the camera being in the courtroom really hurt the prosecution more than it did the defense, because like you said, people were playing up. Even the witnesses, there was a couple of witnesses who looked like they were trying out for the Academy Award. Sure. You know, so it was just such a bizarre trial. For me, it the point where I realized this was going to be not guilty actually came during the defense, when they brought this old man up. And my memory, I've tried to find the guy's name and what he was testifying about, but I remember it being a very minor point. And the defense had called him to verify that he saw somebody doing something at this time, something along that lines. So to me, the prosecution should have got up and just said, okay, whatever, and moved on. But Darden got up and just started berating this poor guy right and left. And the question he asks is, you sitting there thinking, what does that matter? You know, what that has nothing to do with the trial, but it, because the cameras were on and everybody was just all, you know, hyped up. And at that moment, it hit me that this is going to be not guilty, because if I had that reaction, the jury's probably having the same reaction.
Yeah. Well, I think even before that, the jury had kind of made up their mind. Let's remember when this was. This is right after the Rodney King incident,
mm-hmm.
right after that trial. It was not LAPD's finest moment. I mean, that video was just horrid. It looked terrible. Mm-hmm. And this is not the LAPD that I was in, that I recognized, or anything else. That whole incident was handled incorrectly. And then what happened after certainly didn't help with the riots. I mean, a deadly riot, 50-something people getting killed, and the city in flames, and this whole nine yards. And now we want to put on this this famous black man and try him for two murders.
Right.
If any one of those jurors was honest with themselves, they know damn well that he committed the murders. But this is get back. In fact, one of the jurors came out after on Larry King and said essentially the same thing. This is get back for these racist cops, these lying cops, these evidence planting cops. I never did any of that, nor did anybody that I ever knew did any of that, with one exception, with the Furman thing and the lie, mm-hmm. which was an outlier to begin with.
Right.
So I knew this. We were down to begin. If this trial should have been held where the civil trial was held, in front of a jury of his peers, not downtown, that Gil Garcetti, the DA at the time, decided that with all this evidence, we're going to get a minority jury in there, and they will convict because of all of this evidence. And the evidence was there. We wrote the book, evidence that the prosecution never brought in because they knew damn well it was the LAPD on trial. They did not want to appear in bed with the cops. That's why when I was on the stand, I had a harder time with Marcia on direct than they did with Johnny Cochran on cross. Because some of this stuff came from left field, and I found myself in a corner with the prosecution. I'm supposed to be a witness for the prosecution introducing evidence. Right. And when I was doing that, I glanced at the jury every now and again. They weren't writing anything down. They were just glaring. So it was all over before it began.
How frustrating is that for you as a detective? And I'm going to bring in another case you have nothing to do with, just as an example. There was a case up in Stanislaus County that involved a well-known defense attorney who was accused of murder. And in the town that we lived in, we pretty much figured he did it. Just with the, you know, knowing him, knowing some of the stories about him, it was pretty much a slam dunk. You had, because he was involved with, turned out two CHP officers were also accused of being in on this crime. So you had this multi-agency task force. I think it was the CHP, you had the county, you had two city, I think the state police were in on it. And they spent a long time building this case. And they bring it to the trial where you've got the judge doing a lot of Judge Ito things. And you had a prosecution team that was making mistake after mistake after mistake. And the end result is he gets found not guilty. So for you as a detective to put all that effort and time and work and build a case that is rock solid, and then watch it all come apart because he is doing that, and for your fellow officers.
Well, it's obviously frustrating as hell, especially when you're supposed to be on the same team. You've gone over the evidence over and over again. And let me say real quick here, one of the things in a homicide investigation, especially a high-profile case, it's not over for the investigator once the case is filed. 90-some-odd percent of these cases go on, and that was true in the Simpson case. A really good example of something that wasn't used and should have been used was it was month five or six during the trial. I'm in the office during lunch break, and I get a call from this guy who tells me that he was at the airport the night of the murders and saw O.J. Simpson pull up in a limousine. And when he saw that, it was a little after 11 p.m. at night. Well, the media had inadvertently reported a wrong timing on the murders when the murders had occurred, something like 10:35 or 10:40. Well, we knew that if Simpson was at the airport a little after 11, he couldn't have committed the murders. Well, the media was wrong with its timing, but this guy was at the airport and saw Simpson get out of the limo and go inside. Well, when he saw this and he's listening to the trial when it began, he tells this to the calls the defense investigator and tells him that. He says, hey, I saw OG at the airport just after 11, and he couldn't have done this because the murders didn't occur until almost 11 o'clock, something like 20 minutes to 11. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to him, of course, the media had an inaccurate time at that particular time. So the investigator said, well, thank you very much. We'll get right back to you. Well, the months passed. He never got back to him. They don't want that guy on the stand because mm-hmm. he was sitting next to a trash container at the entrance at American Airlines and taking things up a trash bag, sitting in a trash container, zipped up the little bag and walked inside the terminal with this bag. Simpson had all the stuff in this bag that he discarded. Well, to this day, you know, people were talking, where's the shoes? Where's the clothes? Where's the knife? Well, I'd sure like to know it was in that trash container.
Yeah.
Vince does not want this. So he calls me months later when he finds out what's going on. So I said, where are you now? He says, well, I work a mile or two away. I said, can you meet me there? He said, yes. So I grabbed my partner. We grabbed a photographer and shot over to American Airlines. We had him walk us through everything. We took a thorough statement, photographed everything, found out that these containers were still there, found out that there was two landfills where all of the trash goes three times a day from LAX. the possibility of finding anything was nil and nil after 8 or 9 months. But I took all of this to Marcia, who was calling the shots on the evidence, and I laid out, this is great. This guy is no—he's not a criminal at all. He's an architect. He's got his own business. He's there to pick up his wife. She was running late. He saw O.J. get out of the car. He sees O.J. stuff a lot of things down into a trash container from a utility bag. We've never found the utility bag. It's the same one that Cato Kalin saw on the driveway at Rockingham. Simpson wouldn't let him near. So you put all these together, and you want to know where some evidence just might be. She says, well, it's a little... I don't think so, because it's a one-on-one, she says. We can't corroborate.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she was kidding me at first, because mm-hmm. she did have sense of humor on occasion. She wasn't kidding. You never saw that witness. Why the hell would you not put something like that on? And there were a lot of things like that, because they knew damn well it was the LAPD on trial, and they hoped to convince the jury through the DA that would have been enough. And that's a case, period. You don't hold that stuff back.
Hi, Tom. This is Bobby, the co-host tonight. I have to tell you, I just finished reading this book about an hour and a half ago. I couldn't put it down. Of course, I'm reading the 2016 revised edition, and I would tell our listeners, if you read this when it came out in 1997 and was a bestseller, you need to revisit it. Fantastic book, Tom. Just fantastic. What we're talking about right now, about the evidence that was dismissed, you also talk about some of the witnesses that had really great information, but you couldn't use them because they sold their story before there was even a trial date. And I thought that was also interesting. Could you maybe mention a couple of those witnesses and what they had to share that we never got to hear about from the courtroom?
Well, there were a couple. With witnesses, especially eyewitnesses, you have to be very careful with, because especially in a high-profile case, many times they'll enhance their version of things for whatever reason. Maybe they just want to get involved in a high-profile case, or they try to get themselves involved, but not too much. What we had was one woman driving home one night right around the times of the murders, and she was stopped at the at Bundy and San Vicente Boulevards, which is an intersection about 2-3 blocks west and north of the murder location on Bundy. And it was late at night, a little after 11 o'clock. And she sees, or not after 11 o'clock, it was about 10, well, let's see, right after the probably about 10:35, 10:40, right in there. Within minutes, we figure probably after the murders occurred, it was O.J. Simpson moving rapidly through the intersection, honking his horn and moving through and yelling at people to get through the intersection, and then moving on northwards to where he lived. Well, the times that she gave were corroborative of what occurred. She came across as straight. The problem with her was is that she went to a TV show at the time and sold the story for something like $5,000. And when that happens, of course, her integrity is questioned. And the money thing comes in, and Marcia Corey opted her as a witness. Put it on, and if she falls apart on the stand, then she falls apart on the stand, but mm-hmm. you put on what you have.
Yeah.
What you always keep in mind, though, is the fact that she may well have enhanced that statement. We did have another woman and her daughter who said they saw Simpson on the east side of the murders about 10:20, just before we believe they occurred, driving down Bundy. I interviewed her. She said they were from out of town. I interviewed her three times, and she kept enhancing her story,
mm-hmm.
Which I understand that's an iffy thing. You don't really need to throw someone in there if you don't have it. This case had so much evidence, you really don't need that type of a witness. Usually on a murder case, 90% of any murder case will have something exculpatory, something that doesn't fit, something that says, well, maybe your suspect wasn't involved. Investigator needs to investigate. That can only help your case in the long run. This case had absolutely nothing exculpatory. Any evidence of substantive nature was in one direction only, and that was pointing at Simpson as a suspect. So while there were certain things I can understand they had questions with, there was solid evidence like this guy at the airport and a number of other things I bring out in the book, and especially that 2016 version, that were never put on that it should have. The explanation for the blood on the socks, we were told even to this day, Alan Dershowitz says, my partner planted blood on the socks. Well, we proved beyond any doubt that would have been an impossibility. So that's all in the book. And never did.
You know, there's one piece of evidence that I never heard anything in the trial transcript, and I'm hoping you can clear it up. It's that second glove, the one that Furman found, for why it wound up where it did. Because I admit I'm a little confused by the timeline that was presented in the court as to how Simpson could have gotten over there and dropped it and then showed up where he was seen. It was a little confusing to me because I never got it. I never heard an explanation. So for you, how did you figure that glove wound up where it did?
Okay, well, maybe Bobby will let you read her book, Richard.
Unfortunately, I wish I had.
See what happened. We did a timeline thing there on a Sunday night, a couple of weeks after the murders, and tried to line up the times. I think the prosecution went with 10:15. I think the murders were closer to 10:35 because of the witness that you brought up initially when we started the interview, who got in an argument with Chris.
Yeah,
that's another story. What happens was when Simpson arrived at Rockingham, he left the murder scene. The limo driver, Alan Park, was already waiting for him at the Ashford Gate. Simpson enters the Rockingham Gate. The Ashford Gate is around the corner on the other side. If you come through the Rockford Gate, you cannot see someone coming in there from the Ashford Gate where the limo was parked, and Alan Park was calling inside the home to try to get somebody to answer, which they didn't. Until he looks up at about 10:44 or something, and sees a person walking from the Rockingham Gate into the house. Later, he identifies that person as O.J. Simpson. He calls on the phone, on the house phone, and Simpson picks up. And he says, yeah, I just got out of the shower and to the airport, take the plane to Chicago. The plane was leaving later that evening, about 11:30, so he was cutting it pretty close. Well, number one, Alan Park knows that Simpson just walked in after coming through from the Rockingham Gate, so he knew he wasn't telling the truth at that particular time. Minutes later, he comes out the front door, and they pack up and they leave. Now, from the time Simpson goes inside, there's several minutes where he said he was in the shower, which we believe he was because we actually found some blood in the drain of the shower off the master bedroom. It says he probably was in there for a minute. But in the meantime, what was he doing? Well, I believe that he had clothing. I believe he had the gloves. I believe he had perhaps shoes or whatever else. And he took them out the back where the bungalows are located. This is where Cato Kalin comes in. If you go out the back door of the residence, within feet of there, you go to the right, there's a very narrow, dark pathway behind the three bungalows. Cato was in the first bungalow, and Simpson's daughter was in the second. Cato tells us that evening that as he was in his bungalow, he's lying in bed talking to his girlfriend, and he feels a bump behind him from the wall where there is an air conditioning unit jutting its way out. He tells this to Furman later on when Furman talks to him. Well, Furman goes back following up on this particular information just as the sun came up, and he looks back there and he sees this air conditioning unit letting out. Well, if all, I'd call it nothing more than a junkyard behind the bungalows, that's probably 40 by 40 feet. And back there are nothing but old tires. There's an old wheelbarrow. There's just junk, but people have thrown junk back there over the years. I speculate, and the glove backs it up. That glove was found just below and a few feet away from the air conditioning unit. Simpson's a husky guy. I'm going to tell you that I believe Simpson had the gloves, the clothing, the shoes, and everything else in hand, walked back where it's very dark, and he's got big shoulders. He bumped into that container, and when he bumped into that air conditioning unit, he inadvertently dropped that glove. And at that point, he got a little confused, perhaps, or whatever. He knew the limo driver was waiting outside. He went back in the house, and I believe got that utility. There were still the gloves, maybe the shoes, whatever, back into that utility bag, and took that with him out front. And when that's the utility bag that Cato testified to was wanting to pick up and put in the limo, and Simpson stopped him from doing it. He said, right. No, I'll take care of that. It's the same bag that the man saw at the airport, mm-hmm. sitting on top of the trash container that Simpson was emptying out into the trash container. Yeah. So I believe he inadvertently dropped that glove when he was trying to dump this stuff behind those bungalows, knowing he was pushed for time because he had to get in that limo and go to the airport. He was mm-hmm. only going to be in Chicago a day. I think he was probably thinking, I'll come back tomorrow, the next day, and I'll get back, I'll get rid of this stuff, I'll bury it in the back or get rid of it somehow. But I believe he inadvertently dropped that glove right there mm-hmm. and was in a hurry to get out of it. Like I said, it's very dark bag, and I think that's how that glove got there.
Yeah. You know, the glove story has an amazing backstory also. You all did tremendous research. That was an Aris Isotoner glove, yeah. gloves, and weren't many of them made. You research, you know, that Nicole bought them at Bloomingdale's. The whole, anybody that would just think that they just took a pair of gloves and they, you know, they put blood on them and they dropped them. You are able to trace the whole history of that pair of gloves. Yeah. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, I sent a guy back to New York and he spent several days there with Bloomingdale's and their people and discovering that and finding out that Nicole did in fact buy not just gloves, but mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. While she was back in New York. I didn't realize at the time, once we made the Bruno Mollies, there's actually women Bruno Mollies. That's another story there. That Nicole's sister, Dominique, identified Simpson on the Easter before the murders, which is only a few weeks before the murders, wearing Bruno Mollies at their house on Easter mm-hmm. down in the Bay Area, where Nicole's family was celebrating Easter. Simpson was there wearing Bruno Mollies. This was before the information came out publicly that the killer walking from the scene was wearing Bruno Mollies. Nobody right. knew this except me and the FBI, who did the examination and found out that Bruno Mollies was the shoe we were looking for that left the footwear impressions at the crime scene. Well, Dominique saw him wearing things. And Dominique, her other Bruno Mollies, that she had bought back in New York. Mm-hmm. So I had seen all of that. We put it together. You never saw that brought on in no. the trial. Why was that on?
Yeah, that's probably one of the biggest critiques that a lot of people have is that, and I think you share this view, is that the prosecution never really did a good job on redirect. Whenever the defense would throw something out there, there was never any pushback from Marsha or from Darden. I know I saw you at the trial a few days when you weren't testifying. Did you ever want to jump out of your chair and scream, would you please redirect this?
Oh, yeah. You know, that happened. And there was, you have to understand, one person ran the train later. And Chris is a good man. He did a good job. The glove demonstration was really overblown. That was all nonsense. Simpson could have gotten into those gloves if he'd wanted to. And you don't get into a pair of old leathery soaked gloves when you're wearing latex gloves underneath. Nobody mm-hmm. can do that, especially if you're given an opportunity to act it out in front of a jury in live television. So that's another story. But Marcia, those were all Marcia's decisions. It's not because she's inept. She's far from inept. She was an outstanding prosecutor. She's very bright. She knew what she was doing, and the reason she was doing it was LAPD is on trial. She knew she did not have this jury, and so she kept more to the DNA, which, frankly, was enough to convict you or me of anything. There's so much of the blood evidence, nothing exculpatory about that either. She should have been able to, fine, tell your investigators about that. We want to know what's going on. That's what really pissed me off.
Yeah.
If you want, if that's what you want to do here, that's okay with me. You're the boss. I'm just here to help out. But tell me what the hell you're doing so that I can get on the same page. Tell me what your psychology behind this is.
Yeah.
They never did that.
She was not originally going to be lead chair in the prosecution, was she? I thought there was another prosecutor.
There's another story. My partner, Phil Van Atter, late Phil Van Atter, he worked with her and liked her a lot. In fact, Phil and Marcia got the first non-body DNA conviction in the state of California in a case just a couple of years prior to that. No body, and yet they convicted someone on DNA, blood found on the trunk of a car. It's another story. Mm-hmm. So she's a bright woman. She's a good prosecutor. I had a problem with her in another case earlier where she laid out, or would have laid out, one of my witnesses in an organized crime murder for hire. She was going to file and then at the last minute decided not to file it and left my witness flapping in the breeze. And I had to scurry to cover for this individual because she didn't file a case. So I had a big problem with her, but Phil got to me at the crime scene. If you remember, Phil was in Rockingham, I was at Bundy, and he said, Simpson's in town, we got to go interview him. We're going to need a DA. And so she says, he said, I want to go with Marcia. I said, I don't want to go with Marcia. Well, we can't argue in the middle of a murder scene with everybody watching about the DA you want to go to. So I said, fine, go with her. So he did. And what happened, he regretted later, but I don't blame him for anything like that. Marcia had a certain way she wanted to handle this. And again, I don't have an argument with that. Just tell me what the hell you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And
she, Tom, again, I just so enjoyed the book because, well, it's such an engaging story, contemporary story, but you also give us, for those of us that don't know, we just watch, you know, Blue Bloods and Law and Order and CSI and whatever, you really take us through proper everything. And I wondered if you could just very briefly tell us what the difference is between a potential suspect, an actual suspect, and let's say a person of interest, because that was real interesting. That comes up early in the book.
Well, yeah, that's the evidence is going to solve your case for you. It's as simple as that. It doesn't happen like in CSI in 60 minutes. Sometimes it takes a little longer. We're going to go with the evidence in this particular case because of the overwhelming blood evidence. Essentially, you had three crime scenes. You had Bundy, you had Rockingham, and you had the Bronco. They all had blood in it, and there were only three people's blood involved in all of this, the two victims and the one person who was a suspect, the estranged husband of one of the victims. So you got to really take a look at that and ask, you know, what about this? Well, I told you about Simpson walking up the driveway. Well, we happen to have his blood walking up the driveway, tailing from the rear of the Bronco that was parked out front that had his blood as well as the two victims' blood in it. Then we have his blood tailing up the driveway and into the house. You got to ask a few questions about that. That happened. Now, if there's another suspect, you also take it to that. We eliminated over 50 other suspects who came up during our investigation, something that many people in the media conveniently or did not conveniently just kind of ignored and said, well, they just went for one guy. They just went for Simpson, didn't look at anybody else. If you read the book, you find out we went after a lot of people. There were a lot of 567 other inquiries in these many investigations in this case that carried on throughout the trial that people aren't aware of. But if you have overwhelming evidence, you have to really take another look at it. Who else's blood is at the crime scene? Who else's blood is on the gloves? Who else had the victim's blood in his socks in his bedroom? Again, nothing here was said that this man could not have done it, nor the suspects had anything pointing in their direction. The evidence was so solid.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you talk about is that you use the term interview and interrogation. And there is a specific way that you you chat with a suspect that's an interview versus an interrogation. And I thought that, too, was interesting. When the two of you got to sit with OJ on the 13th? The murders were on the 12th, and then you actually get to enter. Okay, on the
14th,
and yeah. you're sitting with him, and I know there were some that criticized that conversation could have gone another way or what all, but you really explain how you could talk to him at that point, because you didn't you had evidence, but you didn't have results. I mean, you had. And then versus if you were interrogating him, I just thought that was very interesting, the difference between interview and interrogate.
Yeah, well, it's all explained in the book. But yes, there's a difference between interrogation and an interview. Interrogation, good guy, bad guy, we have some evidence we can put on you. Somebody saw you there. We got your pictures right here. I'm going to show you. You were stabbing the victim. We have your fingerprints on the murder weapon. I mean, this is direct interrogation, good cop, bad cop, or whatever. The other interview, you highly suspect someone perhaps, but you don't have the information that you can nail him with. This is like interview is conducted like 14 hours after happened. You have a quick, very narrow time period to figure out what you have in front of you before you, under these conditions, before you interview or whatever. If you have a person like Simpson, it took me about 5 seconds to figure out that he is totally, total narcissist. Another minute or two to find out that he's beyond a narcissist. He's a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
It was not hard to figure out. He's got to be in complete control. Go in there now with no evidence and confront him with stuff that, your finger's bleeding, you got to be there. Well, I don't know that. Or keep taking about 2 seconds to invoke. Say, hey, I'm here to help you guys. That's why I'm giving you an interview. And you think I'm involved in this? If you're good cop, bad cop, or anything, that's going to happen. If he wants to think he's in charge of this interview, that's exactly what you do. You're in charge. So you let him talk. You don't can point fingers at him and say, we've got your bleeding finger. And that way, you don't know how he cut his finger. So you ask him. Well, when you get three different stories and how you cut your finger in 30 minutes, then you can take another harder look.
He was so inconsistent. I mean, it's just
Well, it was inconsistent. That's what we did later when these so-called experts came out and said, well, you should have confronted him. Well, you don't confront a sociopath with evidence you don't have. And what we did, we broke down that interview. I broke it down into like 12 different areas where he was inconsistent. Activities of the night and what he did, where he parked his car, his activities of the whole nine yards, and like 12 of them that should have been brought in trial and never were.
And never were.
Suspect, sit down for 35 minutes in an interview, and he gives you 12 inconsistent statements, and with one very critical area, like the blood, and they don't put that on in trial to show that this guy is dodging direct questions with indirect responses. I mean, you're not doing your job. That interview should have been put on like it was put on in the civil trial. Much of it was, and there's obviously a different outcome in the civil trial.
Oh, definitely. You know, at some point, I believe it was on the 17th, you and the prosecution, you decided it was time to arrest him. Correct me, I mean, if I'm wrong here, his attorney to say, we're going to give him the chance to turn himself in. That's how that worked, correct?
Well, this is what we wanted. This is how I work. We called Bob Shapiro. We talked to him a couple of times already. And I called him earlier. I said, Bob, we got a warrant. And we want to go out and pick up OJ, tell me where he's going to be. You can come with him. I don't arrest him. Bring him down here. And so he says, okay, well, I'll get a hold of him. Well, unbeknownst to us, he'd already bedded him down, and they had a couple of doctors with Simpson, and they were taking example hair samples and blood samples and doing all these other things with him. So I said, we want to pick him up, and we're going to want to book him in. You can come with him, whatever you want to do. He says, fine, I'll see what we can do, but you got to give me a little more time. Well, he wanted time because they were doing all these things with them. So I said, fine. And so I ran this by my captain. It went all the way up to one of the deputy chiefs. And they, of course, this is a bureaucracy. We understand that. They want a show. They want a perp walk. They want him to come and turn himself in. But they want the camera to take all this in. They don't want us just to grab him up, take him in, and avoid the media. So they had to have this big show. Well, the big show never occurred because Bob's called me back and he says, well, I don't know where he is now, this type of crap. And, of course, he'd taken off of AC on a little trip on the 17th on that Friday because he didn't want to turn himself in for whatever reason. Was he trying to flee? I don't know if he's trying to flee. I don't think he knew what he was doing. He hadn't slept. He was on a blood test. He was all screwed up mentally. So he was gone. So if we had been allowed to do what we wanted to do, just door knock him, and he can't go anywhere now, we would have brought him in and booked him. None of that crap would have happened. And of course, that was the beginning of the circus.
Your bosses got the show. They just didn't get the one they wanted. They got the white Bronco freeway chase show. Tell me you have not had another case where you had something that crazy go on. But how, for you going through all that, because you were on the phone talking with him.
On the phone with him.
Trying to talk him down from wherever he was and get him somewhere where you could bring him in. How surreal was that whole afternoon for you?
That's a good word, surreal. It was. I was tired because we didn't get a lot of sleep. And I'm sitting there, and I'm on the phone with the DA, with Patty Joe Fairbanks in the DA's office. And all of a sudden, somebody's yelling. We had a TV up in the corner in the squad bay, and said, "Hey, Simpson's on there. There he is. He's he's being chased by the Highway Patrol. They're on the 5 freeway." And I looked up, and there he is. And I'm thinking, "Oh shit! Now what's gonna?" Everybody's looking around. One of the chiefs comes in. My captain comes out. A couple of commanders come, and what do you want to do? They're pointing at each other. Nobody knows what the hell they're doing. So I got talking to Patty Joe, and she says, "Well, you know, I got his number." I says, "You got his number, his mobile number?" She says, "Yeah." I said, "Why don't you let me have it?" I said, "He's never going to pick up. But let me try. At least somebody's doing something." So I dial it. He picks phone. And I got him here. Some guy ran out to get a tape recorder, and I started talking to him. Then one of the Highway Patrol comes across and said, "This is a Highway Patrol, maybe it was Orange County Sheriff. I think it was the sheriff. Said he's got a gun." And then I said, "Double shit. Now what?" So he's in the back. He's got a gun. AC is driving. And I got him on the phone. Well, if he's got a gun, you got to figure it's real. You got to figure it's loaded. And you got to figure he's holding it for some reason. He's going to shoot himself. He's going to shoot AC. He's going to shoot at the cops. And all of a sudden, the freeway slows down. Some people are running out. They see the helicopters and all the police cars. They're banging on the windows. So I figure if I just engage him and talk, he's not going to pull the trigger. There's only one reason he's got this gun in his hands. He's going to do something with it. You have to figure that. So I'll be about the gun. Problems. Everything's going to be fine tomorrow. And I kept losing him in the different cells. And I kept calling back, and he kept picking up. So I said, "That's good. As long as we're talking, he's not shooting." So that's the only reason that went down the way that it went down. And after all this talk, pretty soon we're down on Sunset. He's getting off on Sunset. I've got SWAT already set up at his place. Mm-hmm. And I tell him, I said, "Before you stop," you know, whatever, alluding to the fact, "you got to drop the gun. Don't come out of the van or don't come out of the Bronco with a gun in your hand. You can't do that, because I knew what was going to happen. I wasn't going to tell him they were going to drop him, but they would have shot him. And we don't want that. That didn't look good either. So it worked, and we got him to his driveway, and thank God he didn't walk out with a gun in his hand, because they had SWAT all over the place just waiting him to do that. It would have been a very bad scene. But that whole thing was about the gun. It wasn't about him being a murderer or anything else. It was to get his mind off of the gun and on other things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, coming on the heels of Rodney King and the riots, if he had come out with that gun, and if they'd had to shoot him, I can just imagine what LA would have done. I mean, that it probably would have been Rodney King all over again.
Not good imagery.
Yeah. No.
Not after all the phone conversations and all the things on the freeway. It would be, why did you let him do that? Well, that's exactly why I was talking to him, so he wouldn't do that. So it worked out. Sometimes things work out, sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
I just want to quickly, I know I'm looking at our time. For those that haven't read the revised book, could you just maybe tell us some of what you'll find in the revised edition, updated and revised?
Yeah, there was a lot of things that we also put into here that had to do with several of the internal investigations. There were like 9 internal investigations in this case involving different things that the cops were investigated for doing. One of them was an on-duty LAPD sergeant was actually covering for OJ when he was left his house, trying to dodge the media, and they had AC Cowling's actually covered up. And this officer snuck him out the back, and I'm thinking, what the hell would he do that for? This is an active duty LA cop that's doing this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it. I think that there were investigations that Simpson had was actually purchased at the LA Police Academy by a Los Angeles police officer, and given it, and several others were given to the Raiders. And one of the Raiders had given the gun to Simpson. So this was another situation that doesn't make the police look good, and that was investigated. So there were a bunch of stuff like that that happened. There's also the media, the inaccurate media reports that were unbelievable. Some of these things that I address, there were a couple of TV specials that were absolute garbage. The nicest thing I can say about them is that they were totally inaccurate. They just, like I said before, filled in the blanks by themselves. It just wasn't reality.
Mm-hmm.
I've got this perception versus reality throughout the trial. You've heard all these phony things that the cops were supposedly did, and I show the reality of those perceptions were absolutely that's correct. Like I said earlier, Simpson was the only suspect we looked at when there were actually like over 50. I go into all of the players involved, most of the attorneys and my relationship with them and the games that they played. And then, like I said, I call it the scheme team on mask. And that's when I go and talk about that. And I go into the interview and the inconsistencies. I broke down the entire interview with all of the inconsistencies that should have been used in the trial and that never were.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this in 2016. So
that's mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, fascinating.
Well, Tom, we are coming up to the end of this segment, so we're going to have to start wrapping up here. I want to thank you for going the extra hour with us and putting up with some of our questions. And like I said, I came into this because I've always wanted to talk to somebody connected with the case. Trust me, I have a whole nother whiteboard of questions I could have asked. We're out of time, so I can't. But I will definitely this week, not this week, but as soon as I can, I'll grab that book. And anybody who is interested, get the book.
Yeah.
I will say this. You've never found the Columbia hit team, right?
No, we're still looking.
Okay. All right.
I hope
so. All right, Tom, thank you so much for being on. We're gonna wrap this up. Next week's guest is Peggy Chambers, a returning author, and we love talking to Peggy. Me and Jim, grieve as much as we can. But in the meantime, we are out of time. So I want to say, on behalf of our host, Jim Christina, Russ Avison, who was here earlier, my wonderful partner in crime, Bobby Jean Bell, and the bookie, without whom we can't do any of this, and along with Sam Hassan, who is our engineer and owner of LA Talk Radio, thank you for joining us, and we are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.